This is The Guardian.
In Norway, a woman's boyfriend forgets who she is overnight. In Detroit, a man is arrested, but he was never at the crime scene. In Spain, disturbing pictures of young girls have appeared, and no one knows who's behind them. Something strange is happening. A collision between people and artificial intelligence. Discover more in The Guardian series Black Box. Listen to the whole series right now, wherever you get your podcasts.
But let me say this clearly and unequivocally. Nigel Farage isn't a friend of the working class. He's a fraud.
I don't think anybody wants to see this proposal around the winter fuel allowance brought in.
Until we wake up and Kemi Badenoch doesn't exist anymore, I don't wish ill of her, I just wish her to shut up.
No, I will not shut up.
I'm Pippa Carrera.
And I'm Kieran Stacey.
You're listening to Politics Weekly Westminster for The Guardian.
Pippa, we've got big votes in the Commons this week. We've got the PM going off on foreign trips. We've got party conferences starting, well, now. It feels like politics is back.
It does. Gradually, we've been kind of ramping up over the last week or so, haven't we, from the summer holidays. And we also have this week the first serious test of resolve on Keir Starmer's tough decisions, which we've talked about before and we've heard so much about over the last few days, when it comes to the winter fuel payment row.
So we've got this vote on Tuesday. The vote, as far as I can tell, doesn't really mean anything. I mean, apart from anything else, the government's got a big enough majority to win it. And anyway, this is a vote, this is a decision that gets made at a budget, really. It's not something that Parliament would normally vote on. But I guess this is a vote for the Labour Party to show whether or not it's united on some of the tough things it has to do, you know, now that it's in government. And we were both, I think, quite surprised when our colleague Peter Walker wrote a story over the weekend saying that they were now expecting up to 50 rebels. I mean, that just seems an extraordinarily high number. But I guess most of those are probably going to be abstentions, right?
Yeah, I think it's probably just worth taking a step back and thinking about why so many Labour MPs are upset about this. So the Winter Fuel Allowance was something which was brought in by Gordon Brown to help the poorest pensioners who were struggling with the cost of paying their fuel bills over the winter. And it now represents about £300 a year to pensioners. And what the government has done is when it came into office, Rachel Reeves said that there was this £22 billion black hole in the public finances which needed to be filled. And one of the ways that they decided that they would fill it is to means test this benefit so that about 10 million people who previously got it no longer would. And only the poorest pensioners, who are those claiming pensions credit, would get it. The idea being that they could save themselves 1.5 billion quid towards that 22 billion, and it would go some way to helping them balance the books again. The problem is that it isn't just the wealthiest pensioners who are giving up this 300 quid a year. It's many of those on the breadline, and charities and others have done analysis which suggests that there's probably about 2 million pensioners who are just above the threshold that they'll no longer receive the benefit, but are still in poverty.
So this is the question that's occurred to me, I think, in the last couple of weeks. We have known for a while that this is essentially going to be a government run by people who are either former civil servants or who kind of are quite civil servant-y in their mindset. Keir Starmer, former Director of Public Prosecutions, Rachel Reeves, former Bank of England, Sue Gray, obviously, veteran civil servant. Do you think that what's going on here is that they've come into government, they've been presented with a list of options by the civil service, they've accepted it, and they kind of make a virtue of that, thinking, well, that's the sensible thing to do, that's the kind of thing the last government didn't do, and then they failed to sell the politics because they're just not political enough?
I think that's exactly what's happened. In fact, I know that's what happened, that on the first weekend that Rachel Reeves and her team arrived at the Treasury, they were presented with a piece of paper, or probably quite a lot of pieces of paper, which set out the £22 billion black hole and what option A would be for filling that. Mm-hmm. And it feels to me that they have gone for option A rather than sort of challenging or pushing back. And since then, we've spoken to quite a lot of people with experience of the Treasury, whether that is as Labour ministers or Conservative ministers. And they've sort of said, you know, this is what the Treasury does. I mean, George Osborne, former Chancellor, was saying last week, suggesting that they put these decisions in front of you and very much make it clear that this is the preferred option. Mm-hmm. And what ministers, politicians need to do is to push back a bit and to say, well, actually, is this really what we want to do? What is the political fallout of this? And it feels to me that now, while this vote will go through and we should get back to where we started, this is a big test of the government's whipping ability, because I don't think what we're going to see is dozens and dozens of Labour MPs voting against, not least because they have the threat of suspension hanging over them. If you remember, that's what the government did back mm-hmm. in July when there was that small rebellion with seven MPs voting on the two-child benefit cap, ended up being suspended for several months. So the whips of that is sort of a threat that they can deploy. But I think what you might see happen is that dozens of Labour MPs, deeply uncomfortable with this, decide to abstain on this secondary legislation, which brings in the change. And that abstention will be their sort of like their silent protest, mm-hmm. if you like. But they will be remembering that with the two-child benefit cap, those who abstained weren't punished. So they will both be able to sort of have their protest, but not sort of go to the extent that they end up getting kicked out, even temporarily, from the Labour Party.
Yeah, exactly. So there were seven people who voted for the SNP's motion on the two-child benefit cap. They all lost the whip, John McDonnell being one of the most high-profile of those. But there were several others who abstained and were not punished. So I think what's going to happen, presuming that, you know, Labour whips take the same precedent this time, there will be mass abstentions. And then what will happen is we in Westminster will simply adjust. We'll start calling it a rebellion if people abstain. And that will be the kind of acid test. Well, have people abstained? Well, then that's a rebellion nowadays, you know. By making it so difficult for people to vote against, fine, but there is still this release valve.
So I think, well, ultimately, Keir Starmer is still going to get this through, right? But he's going to get it through with it being quite clear to the public that his party is not 100% with him on this. And that makes his position more vulnerable. Yep. It makes his decision more open to criticism. And it means that that test of resolve that we talked about comes with a whole load of sort of caveats and questions attached about his judgment. And that's something that, when you consider that this is sort of the first big row, if you like, of this government, parliamentary row, that's something that will stick or has the potential to stick, and he's going to need to watch. But I also think we need to look at whether there will be further mitigations going forward, because even though the government has sort of talked about the triple lock and talked about sort of the other benefits that people are entitled to, there's going to be a huge amount of pressure, not to U-turn, because after the vote, frankly, it'll be too late to U-turn. The measure will come in, the proposal will come in, but to put in place extra support for those people, those millions of people that we've talked about who are most going to be affected by this change. So I think we'll have our eyes on at the budget, particularly at the end of October, on what support there could be for those poorest pensioners to in some way, you know, make up for this, to help with this. Whether politically it's too late, well, we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, and it also becomes a bit of a strength test, doesn't it? You know, if there is any sense of backy way, then you've lost your strength test and now your standing in Parliament is knocked that way. So it's a difficult one to get right. But you are just about to dash off to Brighton, right?
I am, and I'm going for the Trade Union Congress, which is their annual meeting of all sort of the union general secretaries and union members coming together to sort of agree a sort of a joint strategy. And we've already had this morning Sharon Graham, who is one of the more outspoken union leaders, she's mm-hmm. the general secretary of Unite, saying that the government should U-turn, should be big and brave enough to U-turn on the winter fuel allowance, and that they should look more at taxing the wealthier to plug the gap instead. And I'm sure that debate will bubble on in the mm-hmm. conference halls and the bars of Brighton over the next few days. But the big issues on the agenda are public sector pay and, of course, workers' rights. And I think back to this time 12 months ago when the TUC met in Liverpool just before the election, you know, Labour on the brink of power. And Keir Starmer's message to union leaders then was eyes on the prize. Mm. They had obviously thrashed out all the details of Labour's workers' rights package. So union leaders were pretty upbeat. And of course, now they're meeting with a very different political landscape. Labour is in government and the union leaders will be very keen to remind the Labour government, including Deputy PM Angela Rayner, who's going to be addressing them, at a private dinner this evening, that they expect them to deliver. And key to that will be her New Deal for Working People, which the government had promised within 100 days of coming to power. And we've had a lot in recent weeks, a lot of warnings about how this is going to impact on their costs, on their recruitment, and sort of sounding the alarm about some of the measures, from foreign rehire to zero hours contracts to the one which seems to come up the most, which is rights, day one rights, so rights which workers are entitled to from the very first day of employment. There's quite a lot of worry among some business groups, lobbying groups, about those things. Of course, there's going to be a consultation. So every side, including the unions and the businesses, will have the opportunity to have their say. But I think we'll expect to see the TUC is a firm warning from the union chiefs that they do not expect that consultation to lead to a watering down of some of those proposals, which just before the election, if you cast your mind back, there was a moment where the Labour leadership attempted to redraft proposals which had been agreed by the TUC and got short thrift and had to drop them. So they will be keeping a keen eye on making sure that those workers' rights proposals stay in place. And public sector pay, of course, Kieran, is going to be another one, another big one that will be under discussion in the next few days.
Yeah, well, I think Labour's bought themselves some time on both public sector pay and workers' rights. Public sector pay by signing a load of deals very quickly. And yes, that obviously increases pressure from other unions to do the same. But I think also it will add to a slightly more buoyant mood at the TUC. This is a government who, you know, is willing to do deals quickly, get it over the line, you know, is actually listening to our concerns. And then on workers' rights, they've basically just kicked everything into the long grass with these series of consultations. But at some point, they're going to have to decide. You know, at some point, Keir Starmer has to decide whether he is going to lead this government of growth, this pro-business government that he's talked about a lot of the time, or whether he's going to fundamentally rebalance Britain's workers' rights and the balance between corporate power and worker power in this country. And you can't really do both.
Well, I think Labour's argument is that if you want to be pro-business, you have to also be pro-worker. And that actually a lot of the measures that they're proposing are things which would create a level playing field with good employers, because good employers do a lot of these things anyway. And it's about making sure that all employers offer the same rights. Now, union leaders have told me in recent days that when they actually deal with individual businesses, the businesses are quite supportive. It's the lobbying groups that represent the businesses that are kind of shouting loudest about it. So we'll have to sort of, you know, go to them and see what they think about it all. And you're right on public sector pay, of course. Keir Starmer's government reached settlement with ASLEF, the train drivers union, and also there's an offer on the table for junior doctors as well, which hopefully will resolve those disputes. But I think for the unions, that's not going far enough. And Paul Novak, who's the general secretary of the TUC, told me last week that they don't just want pay restoration deals, as they call them. So obviously, in real terms, public sector pay fell on average by 3.6% over the last 14 years of Conservative government. They don't just want payback back up to the level it would have been at otherwise. They want to go further. And that's where I think it's going to get really tricky. The union's argument is, of course, that if you want to repair public services, you need to address the single biggest crisis which most of them are facing, which is recruitment and retention. And to do that, pay is obviously, it's not just pay, it's about conditions too, but pay is a core part of that. So it's going to be interesting to see how the government responds to those calls for, you know, even higher public sector pay, and whether politically, let alone financially, given the backdrop, they feel able to go there.
A Labour government is always going to feel under pressure to increase public sector pay, and the unions will keep that pressure up, and that's their job. But frankly, having had these fairly large settlements in the last few weeks, I don't suppose that's going to create... You're not going to get unions threatening to disaffiliate, I don't think, in the next 12 months over pay. It may become more of a problem later on in the Parliament. But I think for now, they've at least bought themselves some breathing space. And we're back in Westminster while you're sunning yourself in Brighton. We are going to be paying...
On the ice creams in the Brighton Rock.
Yeah, lovely. We are going to be paying close attention to the Tories, because we shouldn't forget that they are here and they are doing things and they are important and worth paying attention to. And right now, they are in the middle of this very extended leadership contest. There are now 5 candidates after Priti Patel was knocked out last week. So we still have Kemi Badenoch, Robert Jenrick, Tom Tugendhat, James Cleverly. I'm going to miss
Mel Stride.
Mel Stride, who is still in the contest.
Yeah, despite predictions to the contrary.
And those five people are going to go up in front of MPs later on today. That's Monday. And from what I'm told, those hustings are going to be different from last week's hustings because they're not going to go one at a time. They're actually all going to be there together, which hopefully should create some fireworks and means that, you know, all those barbs that they're proxies and allies have been throwing at each other in the media, now they're going to get a chance to actually, you know, say them themselves to each other's faces in front of a whole group of the 1922 committee.
It's going to be quite interesting to see whether they go there, isn't it? Because right at the beginning of this contest, aware of some of the sort of the bitterness and the infighting which had taken place in the media aftermath of the Conservative election defeat, Bob Blackman, the chair of the 1922 committee, had said he was going to deploy this yellow card system, not red card, but yellow card system, that basically anybody that sort of stepped out of line and was overtly critical or hostile towards their rivals slash colleagues was going to get a slap on the wrist. So publicly, we've had this sort of situation where they've all been like really nice to each other, but yeah, privately they're, well, privately and their teams are, yeah, absolutely going for it.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've got a Stop Kemi Badenoch campaign. We've got suggestions that Jenrick's campaign have lent votes to other candidates to get them through.
Yeah.
We've had campaigns criticising pretty much everybody for, you know, not being focused enough on unifying or winning or the future or the past, or, you know, you take your pick. But there's been a lot of action sort of, you know, behind the scenes, and it's going to be interesting to see how much, if any, of that breaks out into the open, because they're very different characters, aren't they, those remaining five. And sort of, you know, at one extreme, you've got James Cleverly, the former Home Secretary, who over the weekend was the subject of stories and polling suggesting that, you know, he was most avuncular, most likely to be popular with the public, although still some way, like some substantial way behind Keir Starmer, and that he could be seen as a unifying figure for Tory MPs because, you know, all wings of the parties like him, and he's seen as being, by many of them, as being sort of a reasonable guy. And then the other extreme, you've got Kemi Badenoch, who's kind of made it her, you know, it's her stock in trade, isn't it, to be the punchiest, the most abrasive, the most, you know, the most belligerent. You know, she loves a fight. So we'll see how it works out when they're actually on the same room.
You know what's interesting as well? So I was there in the room in committee corridor, quite a grand wood-panelled room last week to hear Bob Blackman reading out the results of the first round of voting. And afterwards, the candidates themselves didn't actually turn up. I'm kind of hoping they would, but they didn't. But all of their proxies did. And we were outside, all the hacks kind of filed outside afterwards, and these kind of proxies were outside also talking about how their candidates had done and what their prospects were and where the contest went from here. And both allies of Robert Jenrick and allies of Kemi Badenoch were at absolute pains to insist that their candidate was the most centrist, which is not necessarily what I'd have expected in this contest, especially since the two of them are both, you know, seen as the right-wing candidates vying for the right-wing vote. But of course, that is that's an example of, or that is indicative of the fact that this round of voting, the next few rounds of voting, are MPs. And actually, MPs tend to be more in the centre, mm-hmm, compared with the membership as a whole. So then there will be, I assume, once whoever's got through to the last two, a pivot to the right as they try and then chase the membership votes. But for now, I mean, it was being insisted to me that Kemi Badenoch was this great unifying candidate from the centre, to which I kind of raised an eyebrow. And the same was true for Robert Jenrick. You know, maybe he was further right than others on immigration, but really he was a centrist. And so, you know, the kind of manoeuvres that these candidates are going to have to do as they look for votes, not only from different groups within the party, but also different groups within the parliamentary party, because as each candidate gets knocked out, they then have to suddenly appeal to a different group of people who voted for that candidate. So at the moment, they're chasing Priti Patel's supporters. Next week, they might be chasing Mel Stride or Tom Tugendhat's supporters. And each time, they're going to have to slightly change their message to get them on board. But as you say, you know, maybe it'll be the fact that one candidate has lent another candidate their votes that ends up deciding this contest. And I think back to one leadership contest where it really did matter that that happened, which was the Labour leadership contest, where it was widely rumoured, I don't know if it was ever proved, that Andy Burnham had lent several of his votes to Jeremy Corbyn, thinking that if he could make himself look the more centrist of the candidates, he would win and then make Jeremy Corbyn look further left. And then, of course, this all completely blew up in Andy Burnham's face and everybody else's face in that leadership contest. So for those of Tory leadership candidates who I'm sure are listening to this, be careful about lending votes, because you can get some unintended consequences.
Yeah, well, we'll see who makes it through to the next round. There's another vote tomorrow. We're likely to get the results mid-afternoon at Westminster, as the five are whittled down to four. Once again, all sorts of predictions that Mel Stride will be the one who falls by the wayside. But, you know, he managed to defy those expectations last time. So let's see
how
it goes. And then we end up with the final four going through to the Tory party conference, where it's going to be quite an unusual one this year, isn't it, Kieran? I mean, we're kind of used to a couple of appearances from the party leader, still Rishi Sunak, in case you'd forgotten, and the conference being wrapped up by a big set-piece speech by the Tory leader. And that's not going to happen this year, because we're expecting to have Rishi Sunak just show his face, one Tory told me briefly on the Sunday, put in an appearance, and then really kind of leave the others to it. And we were anticipating some sort of beauty contest where each of the four standing candidates at that point would take to the stage and get their moment, presumably the equivalent of a cabinet minister or shadow cabinet minister's hour on the stage to address the party faithful. But it doesn't look like that's going to happen, does it?
No, for some bizarre reason, the party managers seem to have decided that each of the candidates should get 10 minutes each to make their case to the rest of the party. And I can't quite understand what the reasoning is behind this. This is the moment for the Tory party to really explore each of these candidates in depth and to almost lean in to, okay, so maybe there's some drama around it. There'll definitely be disagreements, but your party is already divided. They've just lost an election. You might as well embrace that sense of chaos to give you, you know, a candidate that people can really get behind. And of course, we've talked about this before, but people remember that party conference where David Davis went up against David Cameron. David Cameron gave such a great speech that he blew everybody else away, swept the party with him, and, you know, was in Downing Street within a few years. That's much more difficult to do if you've only got 10 minutes. So I can't quite figure out why, you know, why they want to suck the oxygen out of this contest by doing that. But look, it doesn't matter. I'm still really looking forward to this conference. Every fringe event is going to be fascinating. Last year was chaotic because, if you remember last year, it already felt like the authority was seeping away from Rishi Sunak. And it was that conference where the two major stars were Liz Truss and Nigel Farage. And that's who everybody wanted to see in the fringe events. So what I'm going to be going there for, I think, is to look at a lot of those, you know, events around the edge of conference and just see, where's the energy? Who are people queuing for? Who are people talking about in the bars? And these are great occasions just to pick up that sense of, like, okay, this is what people really want right now.
And I've spoken to a couple of the Tory leadership contenders who are, whatever they might think about party conference, and there's some mixed views, seem to be united on the timing of the whole contest, which of course isn't resolved until after the budget. And it seems like a really odd decision when the budget is going to be such a high profile moment to have Rishi Sunak, leader of the opposition, responding to Rachel Reeves. I'm sure he'll be perfectly competent and do a perfectly good job. He knows the numbers, he knows the politics, but he's not the future of the Conservative Party. And he's not going to be, you know, within days, the new Conservative leader is going to be in place. And it just feels very weird that they haven't brought forward, once the budget date was known, they haven't brought forward the contest by a week. Cut short, after conference, that four gets whittled down to two by the MPs. And then those two go to the party membership. But that bit could be a week shorter. And that would give the new Tory leader, the new leader of the opposition, their first outing, you know, with all the sort of media attention that attracts and all the opportunities for kind of picking your attack lines and setting your narrative and your approach for the coming months that affords. And yet they're not going to get it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we were there for PMQs last week and we saw Rishi Sunak do So he did his second PMQs as leader of the opposition. He was leader of the opposition, even though Keir Starmer kept calling him prime minister.
Yeah.
And even though he did a perfectly good, competent job at it, the energy just isn't there. You know, this is a defeated man. He's gone to the electorate. He's been rejected. He can't summon up that fire and brimstone that you kind of need from a leader of the opposition, especially when the government is making a series of unpopular decisions. And I assume that that is going to be the energy of the budget as well. You're going to have Rachel Reeves in her prime, standing up, delivering this message. You know, the last lot completely messed things up, and this is what we're going to have to do. And then an almost apologetic Rishi Sunak getting up and kind of picking it apart, but also having to admit that, you know, he'd just been voted out. And so he doesn't have the standing to be able to take her to task. And, you know, that's a real problem for the Tories.
And while all of this is going on in Westminster, and indeed beyond Westminster, Keir Starmer is also focusing on the international stage later this week with a trip to the White House to see Joe Biden, still president. Not clear yet. We don't know yet whether he's going to happen to bump into Kamala Harris while he's wandering the corridors of the White House. Wouldn't surprise me if he did, given that she's the Democratic presidential candidate. And the Prime Minister has insisted that that trip is not because the US is fed up with Britain for suspending some of its arms exports licenses to Israel, needing a bit of reassurance. He claims that the White House understands that Britain's legal system is different from America's, but I'm sure that will be on the agenda. We're also told that Ukraine is going to be on the agenda for talks as well. And I think it's just going to be the first of an autumn of foreign trips for the Prime Minister as he kind of makes his mark on the world stage. It just so happens there's a lot of international summits. None of this is confirmed, obviously, but we're expecting to see him, for example, at the G20 summit in Brazil. He might even make a jaunt to the South Pacific for CHOGM, the Commonwealth Heads of Government summit. Whether he tags on another bit to that trip, we'll have to wait and see. And there's the first COP summit of his premiership in Azerbaijan, so we might see him cropping up there as well, really getting the air miles in as he sort of makes he makes international relationships, and he kind of sets out on the world stage what a Labour government is going to mean for Britain and the world.
Which trip have you got your eye on?
Couldn't possibly say. Never been to South Pacific, though. Anyway, what else have we got coming up this week?
We've also got Lord Darzi is going to do his report into the NHS on Thursday, which is going to tell us how exactly the NHS coped during the pandemic and why Britain suffered worse than other people. And we've had some headlines from that already. Tory health reforms left the UK open to a COVID calamity was the headline in The Observer this weekend. So I think we're going to get more details from that. Lord Darzi, of course, being a former Gordon Brown appointee into his government of all the talents, but then quit quite spectacularly, taking some of that authority away from Gordon Brown. So this is a kind of memory of Labour's past coming back. Now they're back in government.
And no doubt we'll also have more gossip about the feline antics of Downing Street, which I tweeted yesterday that the Prime Minister had confirmed they were going to call his new kitten, the Starmer family new kitten, Prince. Not clear whether that's after the Minneapolis music legend, a member of the royal family, or the German shepherd dog that he didn't let his children get. tagging this on the end of the podcast because in response to that tweet, I got all sorts of criticism about it not being a serious issue and wasn't a serious journalist.
I mean, honestly, cat news. I could do without it.
So Kieran is with you, all those that were complaining. So that's all from us. Please like and follow Politics Weekly UK to make sure you keep getting our episodes in your feed. John Harris is back on Thursday. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby, music by Axel Kakoutier, and the executive producer is Maz Ebtahaj. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
This is The Guardian.
In Norway, a woman's boyfriend forgets who she is overnight. In Detroit, a man is arrested, but he was never at the crime scene. In Spain, disturbing pictures of young girls have appeared, and no one knows who's behind them. Something strange is happening. A collision between people and artificial intelligence.
Discover more in The Guardian series Black Box. Listen to the whole series right now, wherever you get your podcasts.